motorcade. It looked to me like a million police cars buzzing around the vehicle in which I, a woman in labor, was riding. And they all followed. Into Elmhurst Hospital and up to the delivery room. They surrounded the hospital. There was a demonstration outside of Elmhurst Hospital in support of my right to choose the doctor who would deliver my baby, and Evelyn and Dr. Garrett held a press conference at the hospital to explain the situation. There were actually two policewomen inside the labor room and several outside. I was having contractions every 5 minutes. Finally, I let one of their doctors, a resident, examine me to see how the labor was progressing, which turned out to be a terrible mistake. When he finished, I was bleeding. After that, there was no way I would let any of them touch me again. I ordered them to bring me a stethoscope to see if the baby's heart was beating normally, and a few other instruments I would need because I said, I am delivering the baby myself. It was a standoff for a couple of hours. Then a nurse told me to walk around to ease the pain and encourage labor. I got up, then pretended to fall out, knowing how afraid they were of lawsuits. And the doctors rushed over to pick me up off the floor. I knew they were worried. I stated again, I am delivering the baby myself. I checked the baby's heart with the stethoscope. It was beating normally. That or the press conference or the demonstration outside of the building seemed to do it. They told me that if I signed a release statement absolving them of all responsibility, they would let Dr. Garrett deliver my baby. I signed making certain that they had no control over Dr. Garrett or over anything having to do with my labor. And that was that. He took over. He examined me, listened to the baby's heart, and at some point broke my water. He explained carefully everything that would happen and answered all my questions. He gave me a local anesthetic in the cervix. I didn't want Demerol or a saddle block, but the paracervical block seemed okay. At this point, I was very tired. After that, I was still in labor but felt little pain. I went to sleep for a while. I woke up about 3:30 a.m. and I could feel the baby lowering and I thought I could feel the baby's head. I called the nurse. She said without looking that I wasn't ready yet. When I insisted, she looked and went running for Dr. Garrett. They wheeled me into delivery. He gave me a local anesthetic and did the episiotomy. I pushed 3 times, and she was here. At 4 a.m., Kukuya Amala Alukbala Shakur was born. I said, check that baby out, just to ensure her subsequent safety. The birth itself was peaceful and beautiful, out of sight. It's very important for a woman to go through the birth experience with people she trusts. Later that day, September 11, they still hadn't brought me the baby. Dr. Garrett had gone home to sleep, and when he returned at 6 p.m. that day, I still hadn't seen the baby. He reminded them that I was supposed to breastfeed her. They told him he hadn't written a prescription for breastfeeding. Finally, they brought me the baby, and I breastfed her every 4 hours, another incredibly beautiful experience. The nurses from the nursery were very friendly and kind and kept me informed about the baby's condition. But the staff in D11, the psycho ward where I was being kept in a tiny guarded room, were something else again. They allowed me only 1 shower a day. No toothbrush or toothpaste, only mouthwash. They don't furnish it, a friend can't bring it, and the prison won't allow it. I had to beg them for a bra while I was nursing. The prison refused to let me bring one. Many strange doctors tried to examine me to hasten my discharge and get rid of me. I came close to physically brawling with a couple of them because I refused their examinations. Finally, they discharged me anyway, without the consent of my doctor. The Commissioner of Corrections, Benjamin Malcolm, had signed a paper taking all responsibility for my discharge. They put me in an ambulance, chained me to a stretcher, and brought me back to the Women's House of Detention at Rikers Island. They took me straight to the infirmary and said, you will have to stay here and be examined. I was really depressed, having been separated so abruptly from my baby. I said, I don't want to be here. I won't be examined here. Send me to PSA, punitive segregation area, solitary confinement. Anywhere, I don't care. I just have to be somewhere by myself. Just leave me alone. That's not quite what they did. When I refused examination, I walked out of the infirmary, and they called the goon squad, several large female officers. They all jumped on me and started beating me. They had me on the floor. Eventually, my arms and legs were chained. They dragged me by the chains to PSA and stopped only when a nurse asked them to please stop. They put me on a mattress and dragged the mattress. They took me to the observation room and left me, hands and feet cuffed. I had no sanitary napkins, no means to wash myself. The cuffs cut into my skin. The scars are still visible, and my wrists were bleeding. Later I found out that I had received an infraction for slapping an officer in the face while they were beating me. I still refused their medical examination. They finally brought me napkins. I was left on a mattress, on the floor, no bed, and no shower. I was there for 2 weeks. I continued to refuse all their medical attention, insisting that Dr. Garrett examine me. I refused to eat, so eventually my breasts, which were full of milk, stopped hurting. They offered doctors of all kinds and drugs, mainly tranquilizers. They sent the psychiatrist, who had the nerve to ask me if I was depressed. The disciplinary board met in front of my cell and gave me an additional sentence of 14 days in PSA. All other inmates were cleared out of PSA. During this time, I was still refusing most food. I was so weak, I fainted a couple of times. At that time, it was also Ramadan, when it is forbidden to eat until sundown for the whole 2 weeks. I just ate once a day when the food was edible, and for the first few days, I ate nothing at all. After 2 weeks, they said, "If you agree to be vaginally searched, you can go to your floor." I did, and went to my floor. The next day, the captain came down to my cell and informed me that they had decided to lock me up again for refusing a complete physical from the medical staff assigned to Rikers from Montefiore Hospital. What had happened was that when I returned to my floor, they told me that Dr. Garrett had been permitted to examine me and that he was at Rikers Island, that my lawyer had gone to court, and the court had ruled that I could be examined by Dr. Garrett. So I waited. A white doctor came in and said in order for me to see my doctor, I must see him and be examined by him first. I refused. Then they brought in a black doctor who greeted me with, "Hey, soul sister." He was really sneaky. I refused him too. So Dr. Garrett was forced to leave and I was put back in PSA. They threatened me with administrative segregation. So I sat on the floor and refused to move when my sentence in PSA was up. They gave me an infraction and a verbal reprimand and said the vaginal search would be sufficient. Then the next day, they locked me up again. This time, I was locked in my cell for a month. I continued to refuse most food. They let me out to shower whenever they felt like it. I began a hunger strike at one point, and after a few days in the tiny cell, I was sick. I wondered how long I would have to hold out. Evelyn had filed a writ of habeas corpus before the Brooklyn Federal Court against Commissioner Malcolm and Essie Murph, superintendent of the Women's House of Detention on Rikers, to force them to release me from punitive segregation. I was to appear in court for the hearing, but I didn't know the date. Then a deputy told me, "Your court date's been postponed, and your lawyer sends her advice. See a doctor." It was a lie, but I believed it. I was examined by the prison doctors under what I thought was Evelyn's advice. So I was no longer locked, just in jail, and separated from my child. Leftovers. What is left? After the bars and the gates and the degradation, what is left? After the lock-ins and the lockouts and the lock-ups, what is left? I mean, after the chains that get entangled in the gray of one's matter, after the bars that get stuck in the hearts of men and women, what is left? After the tears and disappointments, after the lonely isolation, after the cut wrist and the heavy noose, what is left? I mean, like after the commissary kisses and the get your shit off blues, after the hustler has been hustled, what is left. After the murder burgers and the goon squads and the tear gas, after the bulls and the bullpens and the bullshit, what is left? Like after you know that God can't be trusted. After you know that the shrink is a pusher, that the word is a whip, and the badge is a bullet, what is left? After you know that the dead are still walking, after you realize that silence is talking, that outside and inside are just an illusion, what is left? I mean, like, where is the sun? Where are her arms and where are her kisses? There are lip prints on my pillow. I am searching. What is left? I mean, like, nothing is standstill and nothing is abstract. The wing of a butterfly can't take flight. The foot on my neck is part of a body. The song that I sing is part of an echo. What is left? I mean, like, love is specific. Is my mind a machine gun? Is my heart a hacksaw? Can I make freedom real? Yeah, what is left? I am at the top and bottom of a lowerarchy. I'm an earth lover from way back. I'm in love with losers and laughter. I'm in love with freedom and children. Love is my sword and truth is my compass. What is left? Chapter 10. The next several years of high school passed uneventfully. Because I was spending weekends with my mother, we became closer. During my 17th year, however, I decided to quit school, get a job, and live on my own. My entrance into the working world was a rude awakening. I didn't even know what most of the want ads meant. Auditor, copywriter, accounts receivable, key punch operator were all foreign words to me. Every day I hit the pavement with my best office-looking clothes on and a pair of high-heeled torture shoes. Every day I came home more frustrated than the day before. I didn't know how to do anything, had no experience, and was black to boot. Finally, I paid some employment agency 1 or 2 weeks' salary for the privilege of getting me one of those dingy, boring $95-a-week jobs. I was one of those slaves where you pay a fifth of your salary for taxes, some more for Social Security, another $5 a month for union dues, and the rest was not even enough to die on. It seemed that the whole world was made up of things I couldn't afford. After I paid the rent on my furnished room, spent car fare, and bought food, I had just enough money to buy an air sandwich. The only saving grace was that I didn't have too much time to hang out. I was going to night school, so I would leave my boring job and go to boring night school to diagram sentences, memorize garbage, and prepare for a high school diploma that meant nothing in the job market. My life was being spent pushing around meaningless papers that had nothing to do with living. I wasn't doing anything positive. I wasn't making anything, creating anything, or contributing to anything. After a while, I wanted to tell them to take their papers and their job and shove it. But at first, it wasn't like that. After weeks of looking for a job, I was grateful just to have one. I didn't think about low pay, indecent working conditions, no medical benefits. Only 1 week vacation. I was just happy to be working. I identified with the job and talked about our company and told people what we manufactured. I wasn't making 2 cents over lunch money and talked like I owned the place. I remember once I was working at some joint where they made trailers. I had a job pushing papers. I told one of my aunt's friends that she should buy one of those trailers if she ever wanted one. She looked at me like I was crazy. Why? She asked. Are they going to give me a discount? I felt so stupid. It hit me. They wouldn't even give me a discount, and I was working there. The longer I worked at those places, the shorter my patience got. Half the time, I didn't even want to hear that rinky-dink stuff they talked about at the office. I got sick of listening to gossip about the bosses, and this and that, and who was messing with who. After a while, I stayed pretty much to myself. And when I wasn't busy, I would stick a book between some pages and read. That was back in the mid-60s, and papers were filled with stories about riots. At the time, I really didn't know what to think about the riots. The only thing I can remember thinking was that I wanted to see the rioters win. In the office, there was a group of secretaries who worked for the president or the vice presidents. They looked down on those of us who worked in the general office and treated us like we were nothing. One day, I was in the office, and one secretary came in. She was spraying hairspray on a puffed-up French roll that looked so hard it looked like it had been baked on. She began talking about this and that. I was surprised because she never talked to me. Then she started about the riots. What a shame it was that those people were so stupid and dumb for rioting, because they were just tearing up their own neighborhoods and burning down their own houses. I didn't say anything. She prodded. I said, isn't it a shame? Isn't it? I didn't know what to say. It was true that black people were burning down black neighborhoods, but I didn't know how to deal with the question. She kept insisting. Finally, I said yes and walked out. I was disgusted with myself. I hadn't wanted to agree with her, but I didn't know what else to say. I spent half the night thinking until I felt I had the answer. A few days later, the subject came up again. This time, the whole bunch of front office secretaries, who were friendly with the office manager, came into the general office. Before they had a chance to get any words out after riot, I was on their case. What do you mean they're burning down their houses? They don't own those houses. They don't own those stores. I'm glad they burned down those stores because those stores were robbing them in the first place. They stood with their mouths open. After that, the office manager went out of her way to hassle me. Miscellaneous whites began to ask my opinion about the riots, and I made sure they weren't disappointed. I knew it wouldn't be long before they fired me. The only reason I didn't quit was that I had nowhere to go and nothing else lined up. When I was finally fired, I was relieved. Because my girlfriend Bonnie and I read a lot of fiction and poetry, we thought we were intellectuals. Neither of us had finished high school, but we used to go to this place on Broadway called the West End, dressed in what we believed to be our scholastic finery. It was one of those real college-type places with pastrami sandwiches and pitchers of dark beer. We sat around trying to look deep until someone sat down and talked to us. After a while, we made friends with some African students who were studying at Columbia. I loved to listen to the Africans. They were intense, serious, and had so much dignity. I was introduced to African customs, and they spent hours explaining the various aspects of their cultures. Bonnie asked about their marriage ceremonies because she was dying to get married. I asked about the food because I loved it. Curried chicken, ground nut stew, chicken and peanut sauce, and cornbread that you cooked over the stove. You would break off a little piece, roll it in a ball, dip your thumb in the middle and make a spoon that you would fill with gravy and eat. It really made me think about how bad they've done us. We know everything about spaghetti and egg rolls and crepe Suzette, but we don't know the first thing about our own food. When I was a little kid, if you had asked me what Africans ate, I would have answered, people. One day, Vietnam came up. It was around 1964 and the movement against the war had not yet blown up in full force. Someone asked me what I thought. I didn't have the faintest idea. Back then, the only thing I read in the papers was the headlines, crime stories, comics, or the horoscope. I said, it's all right, I guess. All of a sudden, there was complete silence. Would you mind explaining, sister, what you mean by, it's all right, I guess? The brother's voice was mocking. I said something like, you know, the war we're fighting over there, you know, for democracy. It was clear from the expressions around me that I had said the wrong thing. The brother I had come with looked like he wanted to crawl under the floor. Who's fighting for democracy? Somebody asked. We are, the United States. And then, as an afterthought, I added, you know, they're over there fighting communism. Fighting for democracy. The brother held his head in his hands as if he had a headache. I knew I had said something wrong, but I couldn't figure out what. Thinking I had failed to state my case strongly enough, I continued repeating everything I had heard on television, babbling, which only made matters worse. When I finished, the brother asked me if I knew anything about the history of Vietnam. I didn't. He told me. He explained French colonization, exploitation, brutalization, the starvation, and illiteracy. The long fight waged and won in the North, and the U.S. involvement in propping up a phony government after the French got their butts kicked. The brother was talking about names, places, and events, just like he was from Vietnam or something. I sat there with my mouth hanging open. He knew all this stuff, and he wasn't even studying history. I couldn't believe that this African, who didn't even live in the U.S. or in Asia, could know more than me, who had friends and neighbors who were fighting over there. Then he defined the U.S. government's role, that it was fighting for money, to defend the interests of U.S. corporations, and to establish military bases. I didn't know whether to believe him or not. I had never heard of such a thing. What about democracy? I asked him. Don't you believe in democracy? Yes, he said, but the government the U.S. was supporting was not a democracy, but a bloodthirsty dictatorship. He started running all kinds of names and dates on me, and there was no way I could respond. There he was, talking about the U.S. government just like somebody would talk about a criminal. I just couldn't relate to it. But my mind was blown. Despite that, I continued saying the first thing that came into my head, that the U.S. was fighting communists because they wanted to take over everything. When someone asked me what communism was, I opened my mouth to answer, then realized I didn't have the faintest idea. My image of a communist came from a cartoon. It was a spy with a black trench coat and a black hat pulled down over his face, slinking around corners. In school, we were taught that communists work in salt mines, that they weren't free, that everybody wore the same clothes, and that no one owned anything. The Africans rolled with laughter. I felt like a bona fide clown. One of them explained that communism was a political economic system, but I wasn't listening. I was just digging on myself. I had been hooping and hollering about something that I didn't even understand. I knew I didn't know what the hell communism was, and yet I'd been dead set against it. Just like when you're a little kid and they get you to believe in the boogeyman. You don't know what the hell the boogeyman is, but you hate him, and you're scared of him. I never forgot that day. We're taught at such an early age to be against the communists, yet most of us don't have the faintest idea what communism is. Only a fool lets somebody else tell him who his enemy is. I started remembering all the stupid stuff people told me when I was little. Don't trust West Indians because they'll stab you in the back. Don't trust Africans because they think they are better than we are. Don't hang out with Puerto Ricans because they all stick together and will gang up on you. I had learned through experience that they were all lies told by stupid people, but I never thought I could be so easily tricked into being against something I didn't understand. It's got to be one of the most basic principles of living. Always decide who your enemies are for yourself, and never let your enemies choose your enemies for you. After that, I began to read about what was happening in Vietnam. What the Africans had said was true. There were also articles about the U.S. Army in Vietnam, their involvement in torture and forcing Vietnamese women to sell their bodies just to survive. I was so confused. It just didn't make any sense to me. Our government couldn't do anything that bad, I told Bonnie. There had to be some other information. I couldn't even understand what we were doing there in the first place. Some kind of treaty, they said, but it didn't make any sense. I got so disgusted at one point that I said I wasn't going to read the news anymore. Ignorance is bliss, Bonnie said. The hell it is, I answered. I damn sure didn't want to be as ignorant as I had been. When you don't know what's going on in the world, you're at a definite disadvantage. I decided I'd keep trying to follow what was happening, but I still couldn't believe the U.S. was doing all the foul things I was reading in the newspapers. What do you mean you don't believe it? Bonnie asked. Just take a look at what they're doing to you. The difference between the Africans and the other friends I hung out with that summer were startling. I remember one day at the beach. Everybody is hee-hee happy. It's party time. A multicolored umbrella stands defiantly against the breeze. Blankets and silly-looking beach towels color the beach, along with soda cans and bottles of Bacardi and Johnny Walker Black. Healthy-looking black men wearing turned-down sailor hats and college sweatshirts with cut-off sleeves lugged ice chests and other stuff back and forth. An improvised outdoor sound system has been hooked up, and Martha and the Vandellas are wailing in the background. I am insisting on reading James Baldwin, even though the wind keeps flapping the pages. Anguished voices scream and moan from the pages. Compressed ghettos threaten to explode. Poverty and fire and brimstone boil over into a deadly stew, but the beautiful people refuse to let me read in peace. My girlfriend has insisted on fixing me up with Mr. Wonderful, who turns out to be an egomaniac, decked out in monogrammed swimming trunks, a matching terry cloth robe, and a monogrammed towel to boot. Mr. Wonderful consents to grace me with his presence. His looks and manner tell me that I should be grateful, because he is definitely what's happening. His ride is a red MG convertible, his crib is in Esplanade Gardens, and his gig is an assistant manager for some bank downtown. He is cool from his reel-to-reel tape deck to his color TV, right down to his shaggy bachelor rug, which he leeringly tells me about. He drinks Remy Martin cognac and Harvey's Bristol cream and uses a cologne I can't pronounce, and I wait expectantly for him to tell me his brand of toothpaste. He goes on and on about his trinkets and status symbols. Look at this monogrammed motherfucker, I think to myself. He is smug and insinuating, a black version of Bachelor Knows Best or some such thing. I want to go back to James Baldwin, but I am surrounded by a group of people that talk too loud, looking and thinking somewhat like Mr. Wonderful. They are talking about Carmen Ghia's, Porsches, Corvettes, and other cars that are deemed in. The conversation drifts on to co-ops and high-rise apartment complexes. A young man who has mentioned more than once that he is an accountant tells us the benefits of buying property on the island. An insurance salesman says that he sells insurance out on the island and pulls some business cards out of a little silver-colored case which he just happens to have handy in his beach bag. A red-headed schoolteacher who has eyes for the accountant says that she has always wanted a house on the island with a big kitchen. After talk about the island has exhausted itself, the conversation turns to places to go. French and Mexican restaurants are definitely in, with a restaurant that sells 50 different kinds of crepes winning hands down. One of the men, who is a poverty pimp, says that he has moved his offices to the Red Rooster Bar and Restaurant. Somebody laughingly asks if he isn't afraid to go into Harlem with all them niggas. Everybody has some favorite restaurant on top of some building downtown. They don't talk about the food, just the scenery. Mr. Wonderful says he has a Playboy key and often eats at the Playboy Club. I smile uneasily, feeling out of place. All this talk has given me a headache. Some fraternity brothers invite me to dance. One tells me that I look like a Delta girl. How does a Delta girl look, I ask. Just like you in a swimsuit? Mr. Wonderful glares at them. I am picking up snatches of conversation from all around me. Talks of grants, poverty programs, and democratic politics. Talk of the NFL and the football season. Talk of Bergdorf Goodman, Bloomingdale's, and Saks Fifth Avenue. About speedboats and cruisers which nobody owns but everybody wants to. Whiskey flows like water, and the speedboats turn into yachts. Everybody's just crazy about the islands. Jamaica, Bermuda, Nassau. Everybody is so chic. I'm so tired of hearing about it that I want to send them somewhere by way of foot. Mine. It's a disgrace. Social workers talking about their clients like dogs. Teachers who don't like to teach. A probation officer complaining about how dangerous his job is. A bunch of money worshippers putting on a front for each other. Somebody asks me if I have my thing together. Which thing, I want to know. I take a walk up to the house to get away from it all. Some women are in the bathroom smoking reefer and blowing their hair dry. I go fishing in my bag for some aspirin. Where'd you buy your suit? One asks me. I don't want to say Klein's, but I say it anyway. They have some nice things. sometimes, she says without conviction, dismissing me as a bargain basement case. They go back to talking about people and hair going back. They are putting on makeup to look like black Barbie dolls on the beach. I go back outside feeling like I'm from another planet. I feel lonely and serious. Something has been happening to me, a change that has been a long time coming. I want to be real. Am I the only bad-doing, hand-to-mouth, barely-making-it black woman there? The struggle I've been going through and the struggle I've been seeing is too hard to lie about, and I don't even want to try. I want to help free the ghetto, not run away from it, leaving my people behind. I don't want to style and profile in front of nobody. I want somebody I can relate to and talk about serious shit with. This party is a lost cause. I get my beach towel and my book and ease down the beach a little piece. Looking out of the ocean, I wonder how many of our people lie buried there, slaves of another era. I'm not quite sure what freedom is, but I damn well know what it ain't. How have we gotten so silly, I wonder? I get back off into James Baldwin. I don't give a damn if Sag Harbor sags into oblivion. Me and James Baldwin are communicating. His fiction is more real than this reality. My patience was zero. I didn't want to wait for something to happen. I was into living and living for now. I was hungry, starving for life, but at the same time, I was growing more and more cynical every day. I wanted to go everywhere, do everything and be everything all at the same time. I wanted to experience everything, know how everything felt. I had many zigzag, conflicting ideas rolling around in my head at the same time. One day I was happy just to be alive and young and moving. The next day I felt like the world was coming to an end. Everything in my life was jagged, sharp, unfinished edges. Nothing happened calmly. Nothing was like I thought it would be when I was little. My friends were dying from OD and going into the army. My girlfriends had babies and were looking and sounding old. Nice old men sitting in the park weren't nice old men at all, but were busy masturbating under their newspapers. I got so I didn't believe in anything. It seemed that everybody was in some kind of bag. The dope bag, the whiskey brown paper bag, the Jesus bag, the love bag, the sex bag, the make it bag, and none of those bags were doing anybody any good. I was looking for my own bag, but the pickings were slim. I kept on looking nevertheless, running and moving and hanging out until I was running myself ragged. One day I'd be downtown hanging out with my hippie blippy, black hippie, friends. The next night I'd be uptown hanging out with the hustlers. But nothing seemed like it was for real, you know? The same dudes who would be talking slick and sniffing coke out of $50 bills one day would be scrounging and begging for a loan the next. Even the most successful hustlers seemed to be nothing but flunkies and potential fall guys for the mafia. My friends from downtown weren't much better. At best, most of them were professional escape artists, into escaping the problems of the black community or those of the white community. Some of them tried to escape through drugs, tripping over worlds that didn't exist on some kind of inner space odyssey. But in their case, the drugs were usually not entirely self-destructive, although I know at least one who zoomed dead out of this world and didn't come back. Through my hippie blippy friends, I got turned on to a lot of things, though. I got into poets like Allen Ginsberg, Sylvia Plath, Ferlinghetti, all kinds of novelists, music, food, etc. I didn't relate to everything I checked out, but my horizons got a whole lot broader. My growing impatient with petty bourgeois upward-bound Negroes came to a head when I went to work with a black employment agency. Evelyn had gotten me a job there as a typist. The agency was located in Rockefeller Center, in the same building with Johnson Publications, the publishers of Ebony and Jet magazines. I was happy as hell to get the job since I was tired of working for white people. The people in the office were nice and the atmosphere was completely lacking in tension. The boss was decent enough, and I had a pretty good relationship with him and his secretary, under whom I worked. At first I was excited, glad to be around so many black people who seemed to be doing so good. Everybody was into making it, moving up the ladder. Black men and women with long lists of degrees and briefcases were in and out of the place. They were sharp, dressed to a T, and talked about junior executive training programs, poverty programs, etc. Some of them talked about those companies as if they were going to be the president of the board of directors in 5 years. Once in a while, I went to lunch with a young man who worked at Johnson Publications. But we always got into arguments, especially about Ebony Magazine. Half the time, in the fashion section, they would have these elaborate evening gowns that cost thousands of dollars. When I asked him what black people could afford to buy them and whether they were going to wear them to the corner bar, he got insulted. He was one of those black people who think that you are free if you can go in a store and buy expensive things. I told him that the only black woman who could afford those dresses was Johnson's wife, and he got even more insulted. He told me that everything was changing. Everything was so much better. I said that if things were so much better, how come every time a black person got a good job or was a manager or something, it was news and was printed in Ebony? Our relationship ended abruptly when he accused me of always trying to bring black people down and make it seem like we don't have nothing. I ended the matter by cursing him out, and that was that. These black people went around acting as if there was no such thing as prejudice, and all you had to do was study and you could be president of the world. At the agency, we were working hard for an equal opportunity conference. The idea was to have black college graduates from all over the country participate in interviews with representatives from the major corporations in America. Almost all of the big corporations were involved, and the graduates paid a substantial fee, plus transportation and hotel fees, to participate in the conference. It worked like this. Students made out resumes and the corporate personnel officers decided which applicants they wanted to see. It was a big plush affair in a major New York hotel with a penthouse suite and quite a few lower floors rented out to the conference. I just knew that hundreds of these young, qualified black people were going to get jobs. I was proud to have helped bring the conference about. It lasted a few days, and by the time it was over, I was ready to go somewhere and have a good cry. Some of those black graduates had spent hundreds of dollars to come to the conference and didn't have one interview. The only graduates the corporations even wanted to see were math, science, engineering, and business majors. Some corporations only wanted to interview graduates in very specialized categories like petroleum engineering or geological engineering. Since most had majored in subjects like English, history, sociology, etc., they were out of the running from the jump. I was shocked and upset. After the conference, I went out with one of the black executives I had met in the agency. "I don't understand it," I kept telling him. "Why would those companies pay all that money to participate in the conference if they aren't really interested in hiring anybody? It doesn't make any sense." "It makes a lot of sense if you think about it." "Huh? I don't understand." "Listen," he went on, "the government says that in order for those companies to keep their contracts, they have to at least make an effort to look for qualified black personnel. The law doesn't say they have to hire anybody. The law says they've only got to look." I was furious. They had used poor, dumb me just like they use a drug dealer to conspire against his own people. I was part of the plot and I didn't even know it. There were some blacks who got jobs, but mainly the thing was a sham to make things look good on paper. My friend and I got stupidly drunk, singing oldies by the Shirelles on Lexington Avenue, he telling me about what bastards the bosses were and about the trials and treacheries of the Democratic Party machine, and telling me how I was going to get another job as a go-go dancer in the ladies' room. About a week later, I made up a resume, described myself as a college graduate, and was hired as a marketing assistant. I didn't believe in anything, and I wasn't going to follow anyone's rules but my own. I got fired from that job a couple of weeks later, got another college job, and got fired from that too. I didn't care. I was going to deal with them just like they dealt with us. One time I got a job as a bookkeeper. I didn't know the first thing about it, but after I got the job, I bought a couple of Bookkeeping Made Easy books, and when I didn't understand something, I told them that we used a different system at the last place I worked. The job involved a lot of cash, and I had to be bonded. When you get bonded, they do a background check on you. The job wasn't too bad, and the boss was cool. It was an excellent way to learn bookkeeping and the insurance business. I knew they would fire me as soon as the report came in, but I didn't care. One day, my boss threw a detective's report on my desk. It had my name on it. I swallowed hard, knowing it was my last day. The more I read, the more surprised I became. The report verified everything I had said. Subject attended such and such high school. Subject graduated from such and such college. Subject worked at such and such place. They even reported that I lived on a quiet, tree-lined street, and that they had talked to my neighbors and learned that I was a nice person. I cracked up all the way home. Everything is a lie in America, and the thing that keeps it going is that so many people believe the lie. But my patience was getting shorter and my temper was terrible. I was quick to tell people what I thought of them, and even I was surprised by my bluntness. Bonnie kept telling me, "Slow down, you're speeding. Somebody's going to give you a ticket." She was almost as restless and crazy as I was. We would check out things happening and make a joke of them. The world seemed to be so big and fixed, and we couldn't think of anything to change it. Bonnie encouraged me to stop lying about going to college and go for real. If you're smart enough to fool them, then you're smart enough to play their game. I knew that what she said made sense, but I had hated my last days in high school and had no desire to study anything else. The only other person who stayed on my case and prodded me to go back to school was my friend from Kenya. We had grown to be serious friends, and we dug each other much more as friends than as lovers. He was studying economics out on Long Island, and we didn't get a chance to see each other much. Sometimes on the weekend, we would hang out together. He was one of the few people I knew who was serious about almost everything he did in life and whose conversation was not just about his small world, but about the whole world. One weekend we had arranged to hang out. I think we were supposed to go and hear somebody play at Count Basie's club. My apartment looked like some kind of hurricane had hit it, and I was trying to ease out the door without letting him in. Somehow he managed to get a glimpse inside. "No, we aren't going anywhere," he said. "How can you live like this? If your house looks like this, I can just imagine what your head looks like." I was embarrassed, but I had to admit he was right. I had everything thrown every which way, clothes flung all over the place. It was a wreck. He suggested that instead of going out, he would help me clean up and get organized. "You'll be all right if you just get yourself organized. You can do almost anything you want as long as you organize yourself to do it." I decided he was right. It was time to get my life in some kind of order. It was time to take control. Life was like a bus. You could either be a passenger and go along for the ride, or you could be the driver. I didn't have the foggiest idea where I wanted to go, but I knew that I wanted to drive. I decided the first thing I would do was go back to school. I returned home to live with my mother in her new apartment in Flushing, Queens. Culture. I must confess that waltzes do not move me. I have no sympathy for symphonies. I guess I hummed the blues too early and spent too many midnights out wailing to the rain. Chapter 11. On July 19, 1973, while I was still at the Middlesex County Workhouse, I was brought to the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of New York in Brooklyn, which has jurisdiction over all federal crimes committed in the counties of Brooklyn and Queens. I was taken there by federal writ to be arraigned on an indictment in which Andrew Jackson and I were accused of having robbed a bank in the county of Queens on August 23, 1971. While there were a lot of indictments against me all over New York State I didn't even know about that summer, this is one I surely could not have missed, because the bank surveillance photo taken of the woman holding up the bank with a gun was put on wanted posters that were pasted up in every subway station, posted in every bank and post office, and blown up in full-page newspaper advertisements. They hit the streets on August 24th, 1971, and remained even after my arrest on May 2, 1973. Under the photo was the name Joanne Deborah Chesimard. Above the photo were the words, "Wanted for bank robbery, $10,000 reward." After the feds took a mugshot of me and fingerprinted me, I was arraigned, pled not guilty, and was returned to the workhouse on the same day. I heard nothing further about this indictment until January 1, 1975, when the feds brought me back to the Eastern District Court. Only this time, it was to have me photographed. The prosecutor has made a motion to have me photographed in the same angle, wearing the same kind of glasses, wig, and dress as the woman who had been photographed by the bank cameras during the robbery. The judge, a notorious racist pig, is sure to grant the motion. I have decided to refuse. As far as I am concerned, the reasons are obvious. You put anybody in a monkey suit, and they're gonna end up looking like a monkey. Besides, someone had told me about some trick the FBI uses. They take a photo of you in the same angle as the bank photo and superimpose a transparency of the bank photo over it. If you are unfortunate enough to have two eyes, a nose, and lips in more or less the same place, you end up looking like the bank robber, no matter what you really look like. When I was arraigned, I had permitted them to take all the photographs of me they wanted, and that, as far as I was concerned, was enough. We enter the courtroom. The judge is on the bench. The courtroom has been rearranged. FBI agents with cameras are standing on top of tables. A group of federal marshals are buzzing around nervously like flies that smell rot. They are waiting for action. Evelyn gets up and says her piece. The judge ignores what she is saying and orders me to be photographed. I refuse, stating my objections as strongly as I can. In a hot second, the marshals and the FBI agents are crawling all over me. They seem to be trying to jerk my head off my shoulders. The judge has ordered that I am to be photographed today, now, and that all the force necessary to take the pictures in the way the FBI wants to take them is to be used. The FBI, the marshals, and I end up on the courtroom floor with me on the bottom. I hear Evelyn in the background. "Let the record reflect that the marshals are twisting my client's arm behind her back. Let the record reflect that the marshals are choking my client. Let the record reflect that there are five marshals manhandling my client." Evelyn goes on and on while the marshals twist me, jerk me, strangle me, kick me, and literally try to beat me into submission. The assault goes on and on with Evelyn putting it blow by blow into the record. Finally, it is over. The marshals lead me back to the holding pen. I lie on the bench like a rag doll with all the stuffing hanging out, feeling like I have just been stampeded by a herd of buffalo. Evelyn comes back for a lawyer's visit. She looks just as tired as I feel. "That was unbelievable," she exclaims. "How's your arm? Are you okay?" More or less, I tell her, "My body is aching and my bad arm's numb." I sit back marveling at how cool Evelyn has been. It dawns on me how hard it must have been for her to watch what was happening and then calmly put it into the record. I am amazed at her control. She insists that a nurse be called to check me out. "Did you hear that shit?" she asks me. "Yeah, I heard it. I can't wait for the record to be transcribed. If they don't erase it, I think we've got that dumb asshole right on the record. If they don't erase it, then we can get the stupid moron off the case." Evelyn is looking triumphant and defiant, like she has just put her foot up somebody's butt. "What the hell are you talking about?" I wanted to know. "Didn't you hear him? He said right on the record that he thought you were guilty. He admitted that he was prejudiced right on the record. Didn't you hear him?" I'm afraid I was otherwise occupied. "What does it mean?" "It means we'll be able to get rid of his stupid ass. Anybody else is bound to be better. This judge is out to hang you, and he'll go to any limits to try and convict you. If we're forced to go to trial in front of him, I'm afraid the only shot we'll have is an appeals court." I sure hope they don't erase the record. Evelyn and I sit there speculating on the chances of the record being changed. Evelyn thinks the judge is too dumb to even realize what he said. I am afraid that the judge will review the transcripts and then have it changed. Evelyn thinks the judge is too racist and too arrogant to be worried about the record. It turns out that she is right. She files a motion based on the transcript to have the judge relieved from the case. After what seems like forever, the judge is removed and a new judge is assigned. But before we went to trial on this case, the powers that be decided that I must first be tried on a state kidnapping case in Brooklyn Supreme Court. I had been accused of kidnapping a drug dealer for ransom on December 28, 1972. Evelyn was my lawyer, and there were two co-defendants. One was Rima Olugbala, Melvin Kearney, a member of the Black Liberation Army and well known to me. The other co-defendant was a young brother by the name of Ronald Myers. The pretrial motions were permeated by an aura of paranoia. Mine. No one I knew had ever heard of Ronald Myers, and no one understood why he had been targeted for this particular frame-up. In fact, I wondered if he was some kind of plant. It all seemed so strange. Finally, we had a joint conference, which was arranged by a court order. I asked Rima about Ronald Myers. Rima told me, as far as he was concerned, Ron was just a brother who happened to have the misfortune of being framed along with us, an unsuspecting victim. But everything in this case was so strange that I couldn't figure it out. A joint legal conference was arranged between Ronald Myers, his lawyer, a black lawyer by the name of James Carroll, Evelyn, and me. Immediately upon seeing this brother, most of my suspicions disappeared. He was 19, but he'd look like he was about 16. He had a quiet, soft, honest manner that I didn't think any police agent could feign. He seemed to be just as perplexed and out of it as we were. As I listened to him talk, I felt a kind of motherly protectiveness towards him. We were revolutionaries, supposedly prepared for such things. For years we had been preaching about and denouncing pig conspiracies to kill and imprison black political activists. But looking at this soft-eyed young black man, the thing seemed that much more horrible. Those were very cynical days, and we had developed very cynical attitudes to deal with it all. We had become masters at telling bitter, angry jokes about justice and equality and democratic freedom. But seeing this brother awaken such a sense of righteous indignation in us, so-called veterans, that we were all bitten by a sudden burst of energy, I pored over the discovery material and the police records tirelessly. Remo's tense, mysterious, and determined in his manner. We knew that the state was out to get us, and we were more determined than ever not to let them. The guards came and tore my cell apart. It was clear they were looking for something, standing on chairs, kneeling on all fours. They reminded me of bloodhound bitches. They seemed desperate. I tried to speculate on what they were looking for. One of the black guards, who was halfway decent, was looking funny at me. Another guard, who had always been hostile, looked smug. Shortly after they left my cell, I tried to hook up with the wire to see what was going on. Finally, I got the news. Rima Olugbala was dead. He had plunged to his death while trying to escape from the Brooklyn House of Detention. The makeshift rope that he was using to lower himself had broken. I felt too numb to do anything, or say anything. Some of the sisters helped me piece my cage together. There was nothing to say. Another black man had died trying to be free. Everything was boiling up inside me. I had to do something, and most of my options seemed absurd. It wasn't what I would like to have done. It didn't say half of what I wanted to say. But I guess it was the best thing I could have done at the moment. I wrote a poem. For Rima Olugbala, young blood. They think they killed you. But I saw you yesterday, standing with your hands in your pockets, waiting for the real deal to go down. I saw you smiling your fuck-it smile, blood in your eyes, your heart pumping freedom, young blood. They think they killed you, but I saw you yesterday in the playground. Black skin, sweaty, shiny, hurling your ball bomb into the hoop, right on target. Won't be no game next time, 'cause you ain't hardly playing. They think they killed you, but I saw you yesterday with your back against the wall, muscles bulging against the chains, eyes absorbing truth, lips speaking it, heart learning how to love, head learning who to hate, blood ready to flow towards freedom. Young blood. Young bloods ain't got no blood to waste in no syringes, on no barroom floors, in no strange lands delaying other young blood's freedom. We don't need no tired blood, no anemic blood, no blood clots in our new body. They think they killed you, but I saw you yesterday. All them young bloods must have gave you a transfusion. All that strong blood, all that rich blood, all that angry blood flowing through your veins toward tomorrow. The next time we went to court, I winced when I saw the empty chairs. Slouching listlessly, I thought about Rima, completely unaware of what was being said. There was talk about this hearing and that hearing, and this motion and another one, and none of them made the slightest sense to me. But Evelyn was on the case, letting nothing slide by, citing all of her objections for the record. I was bored to death, completely out of it, until the jury selection process began. There were two prosecutors, one exceedingly ugly lynch mob-looking fat guy and another thin, bearded, wolfman-looking dude, rather on the young side. I don't even remember their names. The judge's name was William Thompson, and he was a black man, which surprised me. I guess they assigned the case to him because they were so sure we would be convicted, and they figured a black judge would at least give the illusion of justice. Thompson was somewhat of a character who rarely sat up on the bench, but constantly walked around the courtroom. While he clearly could not, by any stretch of the imagination, be accused of ruling in our favor, and his political career would certainly not have been helped by our being acquitted, nevertheless, the courtroom did not have that out-and-out lynch mob atmosphere we usually encountered. The jury selection process really stood out in my mind. If anyone can write a book about how a black lawyer can pick a jury and eliminate hostile, racist, prejudiced jurors from the panel, then Evelyn is surely the one to write the book. I was fascinated as I watched her. She was all honey and pie as she started to voir dire the jurors. At first, almost all of the white jurors began by saying they had no prejudices. By the time Evelyn finished asking them questions, we learned that they had no black friends or neighbors, would object to their children marrying a black person, or had referred to black people as niggers or some other derogatory name. After a while, many of the whites asked to be excused before Evelyn even asked them any questions. Most of them preferred to be excused rather than have their feelings toward black people, black militants, and Black Panthers questioned and explored. When you think about the fact that the average black defendant on trial gets to ask prospective jurors only a few perfunctory questions, you can see why so many black people end up in jail. Even with Evelyn putting everything she had into picking the jury, it was a long uphill struggle. But at the end, we managed to get 4 or 5 black people on the jury, a remarkable accomplishment anywhere in America, except for D.C. The prosecutor even had the nerve to ask for extra peremptory challenges so he could bump some of the jurors off the panel. The hardest thing in the world for me was to keep my mouth shut in the courtroom, to sit quietly and suffer silently. Evelyn, well aware of the fact, happily consented to my acting as co-counsel. Although she remained skeptical about my abilities to cross-examine major witnesses, she agreed that it would be an excellent idea for me to make the opening statement. Finally, after days of writing under the dim nightlight in the cell, I delivered it. I was nervous as hell since I have never liked speaking in public, but I tried my best to express to the jury some of what I was feeling. Judge Thompson, brothers and sisters, men and women of the jury, I have decided to act as co-counsel and to make this opening statement, not because I have any illusions about my legal abilities, but rather because there are things that I must say to you. I have spent many days and nights behind bars thinking about this trial, this outrage. And in my own mind, only someone who has been so intimately a victim of this madness as I have can do justice to what I have to say. And if you think that I am nervous, your senses do not deceive you. It is only because I know that this moment can never be lived again, and that so much depends on it. I have to read this opening statement to you because I am afraid that if I don't, I will forget half of what I have to say. Please try to bear with me. This will not be a conventional opening statement. First of all, because I'm not a lawyer, and what has happened to me, and what has happened to Ronald Myers, does not exist in a vacuum. There are a long series of events and attitudes that led up to us being here. When we were sitting in this courtroom during the jury selection process, I listened to Judge Thompson tell you about the American system of justice. He talked about the presumption of innocence. He talked about equality and justice. His words were like a beautiful dream in a beautiful world. But I have been awaiting trial for 2.5 years. And justice, in my eyesight, has not been the American dream. It has been the American nightmare. There was a time when I wanted to believe that there was justice in this country. But reality crashed through and shattered all my daydreams. While awaiting trial, I have earned a PhD in justice, or rather the lack of it. I sat next to a pregnant woman who was doing 90 days for taking a box of Pampers, and watched on TV the pardoning of a president who had stolen millions of dollars and who had been responsible for the deaths of thousands of human beings. For what? For peace with honor? Nixon was pardoned without ever standing trial or being found guilty of a crime or spending one day in jail. Who else could commit some of the most horrendous, destructive crimes in history and get paid $200,000 tax dollars a year? Ford stated that he pardoned Nixon because Nixon's family had suffered enough. Well, what about thousands of families whose sons gave their lives in Vietnam? And what about the millions of people who have been sentenced at birth to poverty, to live like animals and work like dogs? What about the families who have sons and daughters in prison, who cannot afford bail or even lawyers for their children? Where is justice for them? What kind of justice is this? Where the poor go to prison and the rich go free? Where witnesses are rented, bought, or bribed? Where evidence is made or manufactured? Where people are tried not because of any criminal actions, but because of their political beliefs? Where was the justice for men at Attica? Where was the justice for Medgar Evers, Fred Hampton, Clifford Glover? Where was the justice for the Rosenbergs? And where is the justice for the Native Americans who we so presumptuously call Indians? I am not on trial here because I am a criminal or because I have committed a crime. I have never been convicted of a crime in my life. Ronald Myers is not on trial because he has committed a crime. He was 19 years old when he turned himself in after seeing his picture in the newspapers. He thought that the police would immediately see their mistake. I met Ronald Myers for the first time about 8 months ago in the lawyer's conference room. It was a strange meeting, something I hope I'll never have to go through again. I was shocked to see how young he was. And no matter what the outcome of this trial, I will always feel a bitterness about what has happened to Ronald Myers and what has happened to me. I do not think that it's just an accident that we are on trial here. This case is just another example of what has been going on in this country. Throughout America's history, people have been imprisoned because of their political beliefs and charged with criminal acts in order to justify that imprisonment. Those who dared speak out against the injustices in this country, both black and white, have paid dearly for their courage, sometimes with their lives. Marcus Garvey, Stokely Carmichael, Angela Davis, the Rosenbergs, and Lolita LeBron were all charged with crimes because of their political beliefs. Martin Luther King went to jail countless times for leading nonviolent demonstrations. Why, you are probably asking yourself, would this government want to put me or Ronald Myers in jail? In my mind, the answer to that is very simple. For the same reason that this government has put everyone else in jail who spoke up for freedom, who said, "Give me liberty or give me death." During the voir dire process, we ask you about the word militant. There was a reason for that. In the late 60s and the early 70s, this country was in an upheaval. There was a strong people's movement against the war, against racism in the colleges, on the streets, and in the Black and Puerto Rican communities. This government, local police agencies, the FBI, and the CIA launched an all-out war against people they considered militants. We are only finding out now, because of investigations into the FBI and the CIA, how extensive and how criminal their methods were and still are. In the same way that witches were burned in Salem, this government went on a witch hunt for people they considered militant. Countless numbers of people were either killed or imprisoned. The Berrigans, the Chicago Seven, the Panther 21, Bobby Seale, and thousands of anti-war demonstrators were all victims of this witch hunt justice. Some of you are saying to yourselves, no government would do that. Well, all you have to do is check out for yourselves the history of this country and to look around and see what is going on today. All you have to do is ask yourselves, who controls the government? And who are the victims of that control? Since you have been in this courtroom, you have heard the name Black Liberation Army mentioned over and over. Those of you in the jury have been questioned as to what you've read or seen on television and what your opinions were about the BLA. Most of you have stated that you thought the Black Liberation Army was a militant organization. You have said that what you have read or heard has come from the establishmentarian media. The major TV and radio networks, the Times, the Post, and the Daily News. I have read the same articles that you have read. I have seen the same news programs that you have seen. When it comes to the media, I have learned to believe none of what I hear and half of what I see. But I can tell you, if I were just Jane Doe citizen, and if I did not know better, I would have read those articles and come to the same conclusion. That Joanne Chesimard, Ronald Myers, and all other people called militants were a bunch of white-hating, cop-hating, gun-toting, crazed, fanatical